The Chicago Theater of the Air. Produced and narrated by Marion Clare, conducted by Henry Weber, written and directed by Jack LaFrandre, Mutual presents radio's greatest hour of music and drama, the famous Chicago Theater of the Air. Tonight's production, The Gypsy Princess, music by Emmerich Kallman, book by Arthur Miller, lyrics by Arthur Stanley. Our stars are Nancy Carr as Sharla, Richard Tucker, distinguished tenor of the Metropolitan Opera Company, as Ronald, and Earl Wilkie as Lord Boniface. Dramatic players Muriel Bremner, Everett Clark, and John Barclay, and the chorus under the direction of Robert Trendler. Ladies and gentlemen, the first few minutes of this hour each week are devoted to informative talks by Colonel Robert R. McCormick, noted historian, outspoken American patriot, and distinguished editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Tonight, and 1 week from tonight, Colonel McCormick will speak on the Campaign of Waterloo. Tonight's address will cover the preliminaries of the battle, and next week, the battle itself. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick.
Flying over Waterloo the other day, my interest in that famous event revived. Its histories are sometimes confined to the battle, sometimes to the campaign, at most to the 100 days. To account for Waterloo, one must know Napoleonic history as far back as the Jena campaign. Here the Grand Army reached its apogee. Napoleon was still at his best, and had the added prestige of being emperor. For the great soldiers of the period, he'd lost only Desaix, the victor of Marengo. At Jena, certain subordinates excelled their masters. Lannes led the classical advance guard, victor of Saalfeld. Davout, with his single corps, defeated the bulk of the Prussian army at Auerstadt. At Jena, Murat led his most famous cavalry charge, throwing the highly disciplined Prussians into complete rout. After the battle, Bernadotte redeemed his defection at Auerstadt by his merciless pursuit and capture of Blücher's corps. In the year after Jena, at Eylau, for the first time, Napoleon failed to win a victory and only triumphed at Friedland through the brilliance of Artillery General Saint-Armand. The following year, his troops, which they had never done before, fell into a panic at the battles of Aspern and Essling, which were only saved by the brilliance of Massena and Lannes, the first of whom was injured when his horse fell, the second mortally. From then on, the Grand Army deteriorated steadily. Napoleon, having turned the Revolutionary War of self-defense into wars for self-aggrandizement, had to give monetary and aristocratic rewards to his satiated generals. These, in turn, could no longer prevent the looting by the soldiers, which destroys all discipline. Envy of the emperor and fear of his reckless policies bred disloyalty at home, which led to an imperfect conquest of Spain. Nepotism came into his political administration, and even military positions being given to his relatives. His stepson, Beauharnais, was a mediocre general, but his brothers, Joseph and Jerome, were complete failures. His campaign in Russia was wild in concept and through the indecisiveness of his conduct became a complete catastrophe. His subsequent campaigns of 1813 and 1814 gradually worsened and ended in the abdication of Fontainebleau. The great conqueror had shown he could be conquered. Whatever the faults of Blücher and Wellington in 1815, fear of Napoleon was not one of them. When Napoleon returned from Elba, grossly fat and suffering from three painful illnesses, for which the medicine of that day had no remedies, the rank and file of the army welcomed him, and so did the bulk of the people. The French people have always wanted a monarch, and have only been successful under one. French parliamentarians have never been more than obstructionists. Napoleon was compelled to put the organization of the army into the hands of the capable Davout, and had to devote himself to politics. Between Jena and Waterloo, he had lost by death six of his greatest soldiers, and of course a great number of lesser ranks equally hard to replace. Eight of his marshals refused to join him, one of whom, Victor, would have made an ideal minister of war, freeing the indispensable Davout for active service. Other of Napoleon's marshals were either old or sick, including Massena, Napoleon's equal as a general, who, disgusted at having been compelled to go to Spain and not supported there, declined active service. Three marshals had to command armies on the frontiers. Of all his great soldiers, only two were available for the Waterloo campaign, Davout and Soult. They would have been enough to command the two wings of the army as he planned his campaign if he had so used them. The whole of Europe had turned against him. The Austrian and Russian armies returning home had turned round. The Anglo-Dutch and Prussians forces assembled in Belgium. The first under the Duke of Wellington based itself on Brussels to facilitate the familiar British maneuver of escaping by sea. The Prussian army based on Liège. The German General Blücher made his headquarters near the outpost, but the Duke of Wellington and his high-ranking subordinates chose comfortable Brussels. Just as in our Revolutionary War, General Howe put the Hessian troops at Trenton and stayed himself in New York. Blücher's army consisted of about 120,000 Prussians, Wellington's of some 31,000 British, 30,000 Dutch and Belgians, 27,000 Hanoverians, Brunswickers, and Nassauers, an Indian brigade, and other troops, making a total of about 100,000. The British troops had been victorious in Spain and badly defeated at New Orleans. The other troops had been trained in Napoleon's armies. The Prince of Orange, commanding the First Corps, was a novice. General Hill, commanding the Second Corps, had been defeated by some of Napoleon's generals in Spain. By the beginning of June, the military preparations had reached the point where Napoleon could concentrate 125,000 men. With these, he proposed to defeat Blücher and Wellington with nearly double his number. The Allies' dispositions were not skillful, in that the German army based on Liège met the Anglo-Dutch line based on Brussels on the road from Charleroi to Brussels. Napoleon's plan was to break them at this juncture, separate his opponents, and defeat them in detail. The political situation in France was the principal cause for his defeat. Faced with active opposition in Parliament and in the parties, he felt it necessary to leave Davout, his most capable assistant, to prevent sedition in his rear. Certain it is that Davout would have made none of the mistakes that Ney and Grouchy would have made. He might also have spurred on the exhausted emperor, who met the exhortations of Soult and Grouchy with sneers. In the absence of Davout, we called upon another of his marshals, Ney, whose fame, indeed, was based more upon heroic rearguard resistance and battlefield courage than on battle tactics. His choice of chief of staff was mistaken because after Davout, Soult was his best corps commander and was infinitely better than the other corps commanders. It was to be proven he was not a good chief of staff. He had not served on the staff for 20 years. In the absence of Berthier, suicide or murdered in Germany, Napoleon could have chosen some officer trained by that general. Napoleon ordered his army concentrated at Charleroi. His executive departments acted with all their old-time efficiency. No spy or deserter was able to cross the frontier, no ship to leave the harbors. As a special precaution, Napoleon showed himself in Paris on the 11th of June and left shortly after midnight for the front, where he found his army assembled and that General Bourmont and his staff had deserted, carrying word of Napoleon's movements. He felt it necessary to make some changes in its organization on the eve of battle. The army concentrated near Charleroi on the 14th began crossing the Sambre River about noon of the 15th. Ney did not reach Napoleon until the 14th and took command of the left wing on the afternoon of the 15th without time to even meet his officers. It was the announced plan of Blücher and Wellington to concentrate on Sambre and Quatre Bras, using the road between them for their communications. Napoleon also planned to seize these two points. The Prussian Zieten anticipated the move. One Prussian brigade stood off Grouchy and Vandamme until Napoleon came up and directed the attack. He forced Zieten back, but did not achieve another Sauerfeld. A whole day had been lost. Lost also was General Latour, after Murat, the best leader of cavalry charges that Napoleon had. Napoleon had worked with his old-time vigor on the 15th, but by that night was completely exhausted and never recovered his energy. He was late the next morning so that Blücher, in his 73rd year, acting with great vigor, occupied the road before Sambre with three army corps. Wellington, luxuriating at Brussels, was completely surprised. Quatre Bras could have been taken with little effort on the 15th, except that Prince Bernard of Saxe-Weimar, with only one brigade, completely composed upon Ney all that day. It is questionable whether Wellington ever intended to live up to his agreement to concentrate alongside of Blücher. He had taken a strong liking to the position of Mount St. John, where he had concentrated his reserve, and before leaving for the front, confided to the Duke of Richmond his desire to fight there. He also ordered his army to concentrate at Nivelles instead of Quatre Bras. Napoleon, sick and suffering, started late on the 16th, was surprised to find the bulk of Blücher's army facing him at Ligny. The orders to Ney and to Berlon, commanding a corps in Ney's wing, were not crystal clear, so that Berlon did not reach either Ligny or Quatre Bras. Without the aid of Berlon, and indeed somewhat embarrassed by the latter's movements, Napoleon, by his old tactic of engaging all along the line and putting in the guard at the center, won the victory of Ligny with 71,000 men against 83,000 Germans, but with very great fatigue to his troops. Napoleon, as it was his custom, sat on his horse and drilled the troops all day. In great pain, sweat pouring down his face. Ney also, starting much too late, attacked Quatre Bras, and Wellington's troops, benefited by 24 hours' delay, came up in time to repulse him. Ney, with 50,000 troops, had offered no help to Napoleon. Wellington, with 100,000 troops under his command, and the interior lines of communications, had offered no help to Blücher. Ney had greatly outgeneraled Wellington. Dell, all through confusion of orders due to poor staff work, marched back and forth between the two battlefields. His presence at either of them would have won the campaign. Next week, the Battle of Waterloo.
Speaking from the stage of the Chicago Theater of the Air, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, has delivered another informative address presented as a public service feature of this broadcast series. Free copies of tonight's address on the preliminaries to the Battle of Waterloo may be obtained by writing to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago 11, Illinois. The curtain rises on tonight's Chicago Theater of the Air production of The Gypsy Princess, starring Nancy Carr as Sharla, Richard Tucker as Prince Ronald, and Earl Wilkie as Lord Boniface. Marion Clare will be heard in the dramatic narrative role of Countess Stassi, and the conductor is Henry Weber. The Chicago Theater of the Air presents The Gypsy Princess.
Countess Stasi of His Majesty's Court of Kozenov. Until a moment ago, my heart was filled with rapture, for the king himself had announced my engagement to his illustrious son, Prince Ronald. But a moment ago, I inadvertently overheard Prince Ronald talking to that unscrupulous rascal, Lord Boniface, and what I heard changed my rapture to fury.
Lord Boniface, I ask you, I implore you to save me from this marriage to Countess Stasi.
Ronald, my boy, you've shown rare good judgment in coming to me, for nowhere in the entire kingdom of Kozenach will you find such a distinguished authority as I on the subject of women.
I'm well aware of your virtues in that respect, Bonnie, but this calls for action rather than words.
How true, how true. And action is just what you'll get, Prince. We're off for the nightlife of Kozenach.
Nightlife? Bonnie, my friend, do you think it prudent for an engaged man?
Now, Prince, as I understand it, the immediate object at hand is to break your engagement with Stasi, is it not?
Yes,
and
but
you place the situation entirely in my hands, have you not?
Yes,
and then I must insist that you leave everything to me.
Very well. Proceed, Bonnie. Proceed.
We'll begin by giving you a thorough course in romantic education.
Romantic education? Forgive me, Lord Bonnie. I hope I've come to the right professor.
With lads who come from college, who've read the Book of Knowledge, except perhaps a naughty sense of chastity. Romantic education then begins with gravitation towards the world of feministic gravity.
But when we see them closer and hear them murmur also, you're very kind, and I don't mind, provided I can bring a pound or two. We succumb to the craze for the nymphatory feast, our elder and best have before us. We meet them, we treat them, we take them out to dine. We pet them, we let them, for not all night. But before very long, we are going rather strong, believing they honestly adore us. A sympathetic, strenuous, excitable, ingenuous, engaging little lady of ours.
Capture our affection, and they alter their complexion. They're really most obliging in their way. Your charming blonde of Sunday is my brunette of Monday. They find the more they please, the more it pays.
The sparter of holes and the dancers on your lord, the knives that the postman and the floor was. They fool us, they fool us, they never stand a chance. They hoax us, they taunt us, but they're God bless for a dear little wife. If they don't mind your heart, their faces and faces before us.
The witchery is continuous, the slander shapely sinuous, enticing little ladies of the fire.
Do you wonder that I am furious? If Lord Boniface thinks for 1 minute that I can be disposed of by leading my fiancé into the paths of temptation, he has a great surprise coming. How fortunate that I happen to overhear their little plot.
Ronald, my boy, I know of a cabaret where we shall find the most ravishing entertainer ever to fall on mortal eyes.
An entertainer?
Quite so. An exquisite gypsy known as Shala. Her figure is her words fail me, and her voice is pure as liquid sunshine.
But what has this gypsy to do with my predicament? How can she help me?
One thing at a time, Ronald. First, to meet the alluring creature.
Thank you.
Your pardon. May I come in for a moment?
Why, of course, madame, but I have very little time. I must change my costume for my next song.
I'll make it very brief. I'm the Countess Stasi Sharla, the unfortunate victim of a romantic plot.
A plot, milady? A romantic plot?
Exactly. Sharla, the young Prince Ronald is going to propose to you this evening.
Prince Ronald? Propose to me? But I don't even know Prince Ronald.
That doesn't matter. He will offer you a marriage contract to be confirmed in 3 months.
But why? Why would he do this, milady?
Oh, it's been planned by one Lord Boniface that I will learn of this contract and that I will denounce the prince, thus releasing him from his engagement to me. Then he fails to offer his contract, to honor that contract with you, and finds himself as free as the air.
But what do you want me to do, Countess Darcy? And how can I help you? Oh, it's time for my next song.
Sing your song, Sharla, and watch the prince fall into our trap. This becomes more than a question of romance, my dear. It becomes a question of women's honor. Corner table, I watch Prince Ronald approach the gypsy Sharla. He has had careful instructions from Lord Boniface, and as I anticipate the awakening these two conspirators are about to have, I find it difficult to suppress a smile.
For years I've heard about your lovely voice, your breathless beauty, and now that I've met you, I...
Yes, Prince Ronald?
Love at first sight. How often I've scoffed at such a possibility. But now I know I was wrong. It is possible to love at first sight. My first sight of you proved it to me, Sharla.
But Prince Ronald, how can you be sure?
Because my heart whispers that it's true. Don't you hear the music of my heart, Sharla?
I think I do.
Of course you do. The whole world hears it.
No one can keep such love a secret.
Passion is a restless prayer. Love a common bound the sea. Love is an aspiring giver. Generous and brave and free. Passion is a fleeting fun.
Music of love, Charlotte. Please sing it with me forevermore.
Prince Ronald, I don't think either one of us will ever forget this night.
Hold your arms around me, but God.
I can't help but admire this beautiful gypsy girl. She's playing her part well. But someone else is playing a part, too, although not as well as Sharla. Oh, he's seen me, and he's coming directly to my table. Good evening, Lord Bonifaz.
Ah, Countess Stasi. A real pleasure to find you here, my dear.
Thank you, Boney.
Although I must admit it's somewhat of a surprise to me. I hardly expected, that is to come here alone, my dear. Somewhat improper, don't you think?
I don't consider it any more improper than it is for Prince Ronald to be cavorting with that gypsy.
About that, dear Stasi. I wish I could spare you, my dear, but...
I know how difficult it must be for you to, shall we say, gossip, Boney.
To be sure. But in all fairness to you, Stasi, I'm afraid I must speak.
What a pity. And I've always heard that you are such a strong, silent man.
Yes. Yes, indeed, my dear.
Wonder why the girls adore me so.
Is it for his intellect?
Yes, the darlings know. There's a gleam of prehistoric passion in my eye. That is why they fall for me.
That's the reason why.
If my murmur fly with me, girls proceed to fly. If I beg them on my knees, they would merely laugh and tease me. Girls, never think you've any right to them. If you are charming and polite to them, mute adoration doesn't pay. It's thrown away on girls today.
Beloved Charla, one evening with you is like knowing you for an eternity.
Is eternity such a long time, Ronald?
Ah, not in terms of love. Will you marry me, Charla?
But your position. What will the court say about a marriage between a gypsy and
I don't care. Here, Charla, see? A marriage contract.
What?
Yes, to be confirmed by a church wedding in 3 months. Will you sign it?
Well, I... Give me the contract, Ronald. What can I do but obey when love rules my heart?
We seek for joy and see its shadow in a vision. But the shadow flying in derision.
Love, be right.
woman born to drive us mad, 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 mad with the sweetness of a devil's sweetest heart.
See? He gave her a marriage contract. You've seen it with your own eyes.
Perhaps I see more than meets the eye, Lord Bonaparte.
As far as that gypsy girl is concerned, I wish I could, my dear.
Don't be vulgar, Boney. Perhaps I see that you had a hand in this.
What's that you say?
Perhaps I see that this is a deliberate attempt on your part to break my engagement to Ronald.
Oh, my word, Stasi. How could you suspect such a thing?
It won't work, Boney. You either bring Prince Ronald back to me, or I'll take your treachery directly to the king.
The king? My word. You'll strip me of my wealth and title. Stasi, my dear, you can't do that.
It's entirely up to you, strong, silent man.
Oh, woe is me. What diabolical disaster have I brought upon myself? What to do to cheer myself up? Shall I sing? Shall I whistle? Verily, I'm quite beside myself. Things are not so bad. Shouldn't we look for sunshine after rain? Isn't this jolly? Such a gay refrain.
Why so worried, Bonnie? Everything is going very well indeed.
Oh, Ronald, my boy, something has gone drastically wrong with our plan.
Wrong? Oh, no, Bonnie, everything is right. I love her. I truly love her.
What's this? You love the Countess after all? My word, Prince, you've relieved my mind of an unbearable burden.
Not the Countess, Bonnie. The gypsy. In spite of myself, I've fallen in love with Charla, and I'm going to marry her.
Very good, man. You can't marry the gypsy. It didn't work.
What didn't work?
Stasi saw through our whole plan. She refuses to break her engagement to you.
What?
You must marry Stasi. Or she'll expose my whole plot to the king, and I'll be ruined, Ronald.
But, Bonnie, I love Charla, don't you understand? What are the consequences to me?
Oh, blast it all, Ronald. You can live without love, but how can I live without a head?
Well, Lord Bonaparte, how are you progressing with your matrimonial bureau?
Slowly, my dear Countess. Only 3 days until the wedding, and I can't make young Ronald listen to reason.
Then I suggest that you do something drastic, my lord. Like marrying the gypsy yourself.
Oh, yeah, a delightful suggestion, my dear. I could do worse than share my life with such an exquisite creature. I'll take the matter up with her immediately.
Oh,
I say, Shauna, my dear.
Oh, yes, Lord Boniface.
My dear, it's my painful duty to tell you that the prince has been toying with your affections.
Yes, my lord, I know.
What's this? You know.
Of course. Countess Stassi has told me everything.
Countess Stassi? Gad, is the woman everywhere at once?
Now, let me tell you something, Lord Bonyhead.
What's that, Bonyhead?
That's exactly what you are. If you think such a childish plot can be put over on intelligent
yes,
women...
Yes, but...
You put Countess Stassi in a very embarrassing position, to say nothing of what you've done to me.
But I had no intention of depriving you of a husband, my dear Sarah. I'm prepared to marry you myself.
What? This is too much.
Well, oh, my word, I hardly expected such a proposition to be considered a jest.
A jest? Oh, certainly not. I'm deeply honored, Lord Boniface, but you forget that I'm contracted to marry Prince Ronald. And unless you can convince Ronald of his duty to Countess Stassi, I'll take this contract to the king and tell him who instigated this ridiculous plot.
Oh, whoa. I find myself caught between a tigress and a lioness.
Charlotte, you must listen to me.
I know what you've come for, Prince Ronald. I'll return our marriage contract only when you agree to marry Countess Stassi.
But I don't love Countess Stassi, Charlotte. I love you.
You mean you haven't come to ask me to return the contract?
No. I've come to tell you that I'm giving up all claim to the throne. I'm going to defy my father's will, Charlotte, and I throw myself at your feet.
Prince Ronald, I must admit that this is something I hadn't counted on.
Oh, beloved Charlotte, from now on, I too am a gypsy, and I live only to share your dreams.
Light and laughter, glowing faces, clinging hearts upon the braces, gypsy music sweet and more.
Merry dance and gleaming tresses, flashing glance and soft caresses, all the rapture love can know.
There amid the sea of splendor, of reverie and laughter free, in hours so very sweet and tender, there was born your love for me.
Oh, memories of mirth and rapture, oh, memory of love. First kiss.
In dreams alone can we recapture such sweet bliss, such supreme bliss. Dream once again, never, oh, never to waken.
I must put my personal feelings aside. I can't marry you, ever.
But, Charla...
Countess Stasi took me into her confidence, and I must be fair to her.
My dear children, put the Countess out of your minds. Everything is quite satisfactorily settled.
Yes, Ronald. I give you both my blessings.
Countess Stasi.
Bonnie, how did this miracle come about?
It's very simple, my boy. As a suitable reward for bringing you and the Princess Shara together, your father has appointed me Prime Minister of Kozna.
What?
And of course, in the light of Lord Boney's exalted position, I am only too happy to become the Prime Minister's wife. Mm-hmm.
But Boney, Countess Stasi, did you say Princess Shara?
No, by a very happy accident, Ronald. I learned that your gypsy Shara is actually Princess Shara of Montmorency.
Shara... Is this true?
Yes, Ronald, it is.
And knowing how eager your father was to unite the kingdom of Montmorency, I prevailed upon him to release you from your engagement to the Countess in favor of her engagement to me.
But, Charlotte, this gypsy business, I don't understand.
Just an excuse to get away from court, Ronald. Gypsies have so much freedom.
Charlotte, my beloved, it's back to court for both of us. The court of love.
Well, human nature being what it is, my fury has again changed to rapture. A prime minister seems just as desirable a catch as a prince. And besides, Lord Boniface is more mature, with a great deal of romantic experience. Yes, I've done extremely well for myself, and as a noted purveyor of sentiment once said, all's well that ends well.
Joy and see a shadow in a vision, but the shadow flying in derision, fallen in faith for the heart, the shadow vain is there.
Produced by Marion Clare, conducted by Henry Weber, written and directed by Jasper Fondry, the Chicago Theater of the Air has presented the Emmerich Kallman operetta, The Gypsy Princess, starring Nancy Carr as Sharla, Richard Tucker as the Prince, and Earl Wilkie as Lord Boniface. Featured speaker was Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Robert Trendler was in charge of the chorus. Performance rights were granted by the Thames Whitmark Music Library. In synchronized speaking roles tonight, Marion Clare was heard in the dramatic narrative role of Countess Stassi, Muriel Bremner was Sharla, Everett Clark was Prince Ronald, John Barclay was Lord Boniface. This is Lee Bennett cordially inviting you to next week's Chicago Theater of the Air production, the Verdi Grand Opera favorite, La Traviata, starring Nancy Carr, Richard Tucker, and Bruce Foots, and conducted by Henry Weber. This is Mutual Broadcasting System.